The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Hello. I'm very glad to be here with you. I would like to express my gratitude and appreciation to all of the teachers who have shown me the way to live my life, beginning with my parents, and of course my root teacher, Sojin Weitzman, Suzuki Roshi, Richard Baker Roshi, and all of the people I meet are teachers, so I'd like to express my gratitude to all of them, and Gil is among my favorites. The problem about coming down here to give a talk is, by definition, it's always when he's not here. So I would like to talk this morning some about right effort, which is in the, as you know, one of the steps on the Eightfold Noble Path. But first I'd like to share with you, because I feel it so much here, a wonderful metaphor that occurs in the Avatamsaka Sutra, the flower garland scripture, which is the sutra on which the Huayan school is based. It's said in China that Huayan is the philosophy of Zen, and Zen is the practice of Huayan. The image that I find so appealing is the image of Indra's net, in which the whole universe is depicted as a vast net, and at each crossing of the threads of the net, there is a jewel. And each jewel is reflected in every jewel. And every jewel is reflected in each jewel. So this metaphor for the vast interconnectedness of all being is also a metaphor for codependent arising, you know, for the description of the Buddha, that we arise in response to all of the causes and conditions of each moment. So we arise fresh on each moment in response to the causes and conditions of each moment, which is why we say each being is empty of the some separate continuous entity. There's no fixedness to us. We are continually responding to the connectedness that exists among all of us. Each of us affects everyone, and everyone is affected by each of us. So building these bonds of Sangha that were mentioned in some of the announcements are an important part of who we come to be after practicing together with each other. We are influenced by those we practice with, and they're influenced by us. And so I have the great good fortune of having spent some years, for example, practicing with Gil. And with many other people, of course. So I think it's really beneficial for us to recognize each time we encounter another being that we're already connected just by being alive. We're all living one life in some way. So to have that sense of the vast interconnectedness that exists among all of us, is a very important influence in how we live our life. We recognize that every action that we take has an effect on our life and the lives of those around us. And so we become more awake to the actions we take, the actions of body, speech, and mind. So in this, in the step of the Eightfold Noble Path, which is called right effort or wise effort or perfect effort, or many ways of translating the Sanskrit word, not right in terms of right and wrong, but more in terms of wise or complete or beneficial. And there are four elements to perfect effort. One is relinquishing unwholesome states of mind that have already arisen. And the second is avoiding the arising of unwholesome states of mind which have not yet arisen. And the third is cultivating wholesome states of mind which have not yet arisen. And the fourth is maintaining wholesome states of mind which have arisen. So, as we sit in meditation and observe our mind, we see a great deal of activity, or at least I do. Do you? I think many of us don't really realize how continuously our mind is making stories until we sit still with the intention of just observing it. In the Zen tradition in which I have been trained, our intention is no thinking. And it's just amazing how much thinking occurs. So we need to become familiar with the states of mind that arise. And notice if they're unwholesome. Unwholesome to me just means that they lead to suffering. And there is an ancient Native American story of a young boy who notices that he goes to his grandmother. He says, "Grandmother, grandmother, I had a dream last night, and there were these two wolves in me who were fighting, and one of them was kind of nice, and the other one was kind of mean, and she said, "Yes, son, that often happens, that we have these fighting wolves in our mind." But grandmother, he says, "Which one will win?" And she says, "The one you feed." So as we observe our mind, we have a choice whether to feed a thought and embellish it and let it grow into a whole story, or when we see it arising, say, "Oh, been there, done that, takes me to a hell realm. I don't think I want to go there. And we can relinquish that thought. Now, that's easier said than done, of course. Some thoughts are very persistent and are favorites and sort of define who we think we are. And we're reluctant to let them go. But if they lead us to suffering, or if they lead us to harmful actions, what is the intelligent thing to do? You know? Well, not to go there. At least, seems to me that's the intelligent thing to do. And we're all intelligent people here, so. When you notice an unwholesome thought, when you notice a thought that leads to suffering, see if you can spot it when it first begins. When it first begins, it doesn't have a lot of momentum behind it. And if you don't feed it, it's not so hard to let it go. But once you start building it up and getting some energy behind it, it's a little harder to stop. So they say that, the Buddha said that there are three roots of suffering, these three poisons that are spoken of in the Dharma, of greed or grasping, hatred or aversion, and delusion or confusion. The biggest delusion being that I exist as a separate permanent entity. You know? What the Buddha discovered when he began to examine reality was impermanence and not self and dukkha or unsatisfactoriness. So our effort is to not encourage thoughts, not give a home to thoughts that are tainted by the three poisons of grasping, aversion, and delusion. So in addition, however, to relinquishing thoughts that are harmful, thoughts that cause suffering, thoughts that make us miserable, you know, there are various, I find humor is extremely helpful in my practice. I don't know about you, but it's very helpful to me to have a sort of when I discovered, it was a real discovery to me. I didn't realize that I was making myself miserable with my thinking. Completely escaped my notice until one day when I was actually in a retreat at Green Gulch, a session out there. And I was on my way to the Zendo, and I passed a pond there, which is right next to the Zendo, and it was early twilight of morning, which is a time that I'm very fond of. And the mist was rising from the pond, and there was a great blue heron on the pond, and it was just a beautiful morning, as sometimes happens at Green Gulch. And I went into the Zendo to begin my morning feeling really, really good. And a little while later, I was feeling really, really bad. And I thought, wait, nothing has happened. I've just been sitting here. I've just been thinking. I did it all myself. Now, how did I do that? I was telling myself an old story that Well, you know, I have to admit, I was having a crush on someone, you know, and they were married, and I was married, and it's not going to go anywhere. And still, somehow, I picked it up, and then, you go off to a picnic sometime, and then I'm feeling terrible. And I'm, whoa, wait a minute. I don't want to go there anymore. If I did it myself, then I'm going to stop doing it. And I started sitting, and pretty soon that thought came up. And I'm, oh, I don't want to get on that train. You know, so that train takes me to misery. I don't want to go there. Or, you know, whatever metaphor comes up for you that will help you spot it and drop it. I had an image once of me moving a piano and putting it down on my foot. Well, if you don't want the piano on your foot, don't put it there, you know. Whatever kind of image will help you kind of laugh at yourself instead of, you know, what you can do is instead of castigating yourself for having such thoughts, you could congratulate yourself for noticing so that now you can let it go. I don't know about you, but I can get into criticizing myself a lot, but it's much more effective if I congratulate myself for doing something right than if I hit myself over the head for doing something wrong. So that kind of slight switch of saying, oh good, you noticed, now you can stop, instead of, oh bad, you're doing it again, that slight switch is very, very helpful. It allows you to notice sooner, because instead of getting hit with a stick, you're going to get a little pat on the back, you know, from the one who matters most, this one here. Yeah. I noticed somewhere in the early years of my practice that my big effort was to get people to love me. I really wanted people to love me. And what I really discovered in practice, that it really didn't matter what other people thought. The one whose love and appreciation and approval I wanted was right here. I wanted approval from here, and I wouldn't give it to myself. And what I found out was that no matter how much approval I got from outside, it didn't count if I was not able to appreciate myself and to be willing to be who I am. Whatever this is, it has become this over an accumulation of the actions of body, speech, and mind of 83 years. And, you know, it's sort of my creation in a way. And it's really helpful if I will acknowledge it and befriend this being that I have created with the help of all of the beings with whom I have shared my life. And it's also helpful when we give our appreciation to others, which is why I find the cultivation, in the definition of right effort is the cultivation of wholesome states of mind. And for me, the most wholesome states of mind that I have discovered have been gratitude or gratefulness and love. Some years ago, 20 years ago now actually, I had a heart attack. And I noticed that as I walked out of the hospital after recovering from the heart attack, I had this thought, wow, I'm still alive. I could be dead. Wow, the rest of my life is just a gift. And then, oh, it's always been a gift from the very beginning, from the get-go. It's not just a gift when you dodged a bullet. Our life is totally gratuitous. It's given to us by our parents. And so, naturally, gratitude arises when you realize you've been given a gift that you appreciate so much. I like being alive. And a friend of mine was giving a Dharma talk at the city center a couple of weeks ago. She's a third grade teacher. And she told a story of one of her third graders. A third grader must be about eight, I suppose. Six, seven, eight, yeah. And he was walking across the room, and then he started to skip and jump and twirl, and then he went on over to his seat, and she said to him, "Josh, what was that?" And he said, "Well, Miss Bennett, did you ever notice, did you ever forget that you were alive and then notice that you were?" A third grader, you know. So when you notice that you're alive, you can remember it's a gift. And you can cultivate gratitude for that gift. When someone does something that you appreciate, you can recognize it as a gift and thank them for it. Cultivating gratitude in that way, I find, for myself, leads to a great deal of joy. One thing I'm grateful for is for the teacher who ordained me, Richard Baker Roshi, naming me Zenkei, which means total or inconceivable joy. What a great name, you know. I mean, when he gave it to me, what? Where did he get that? But I think being named in that way, it's now, let's see, 77, oh, I got that name. It's been a long time. Whether it was predictive or instrumental, I don't know. Whether it was something he saw that I hadn't seen that gradually developed, or whether having that name actually kind of drew me into that direction, I don't know. But this joy and gratitude are deeply connected. And also love. I was listening to the radio a few weeks ago, and quite by accident, I ran into a reading at City Arts and Lectures by Mary Oliver, who's one of my favorite poets. We have a kind of a web group called American Zen Teachers Association, and somebody posted a question there. I have to do a ceremony for such and such, and does anybody have an idea of a good poem or reading for an occasion like that? And somebody else responded by saying, well, Mary Oliver's poem such and such, it seems to me, works very well in that situation. And then somebody else wrote back and said, oh yes, Mary Oliver Roshi, isn't she a big help? There are so many of her poems which I find very congruent with the Dharma. This was one I was unfamiliar with, and when she read the first line, it just immediately struck me. My work is loving the world. And I thought, yes, that's it. Right on the nose. My work is loving the world. I'll read you the whole poem, but really that's the essence of it. My work is, the poem is called The Messenger. My work is loving the world. Here are the sunflowers, there the hummingbird, equal seekers of sweetness. Here the quickening yeast, there the blue plums. Here the clam, deep in the speckled sand. Are my boots old? Is my coat torn? Am I no longer young and still not half perfect? Let me keep my mind on what matters, which is my work, which is mostly standing still and learning to be astonished. The Phoebe, the delphinium, the sheep in the pasture, and the pasture, which is mostly rejoicing since all the ingredients are here, which is gratitude, to be given a mind and a heart and these body clothes, a mouth which is with which to give shouts of joy to the moth and the wren and to the sleepy dug-up clam, telling them all over and over how it is that we live forever. But in that line, my work is loving the world, I think of the Metta Sutta and the practice of Metta. This is how we cultivate the possibility of loving the world, is to really work at it, cultivate it, feed it. You know, it says in the Metta Sutta, this is what should be accomplished by the one who is wise, who seeks the good and has obtained peace. Well, that's maybe, I haven't got there yet, but still, when one is accomplished in practice, then metta happens. You know, I had a picture once of a monk, I don't know what happened to it, and it said on it, if you attain peace, accept it. If you don't attain peace, accept that also. So accepting what arises is fundamental to a peaceful mind. So one who has obtained peace, let one be strenuous, upright, and sincere, without pride, easily contented and joyous. Let one not be submerged by the things of the world. Let one be wise but not puffed up. And let one not desire great possessions, even for one's family. Let one do nothing that is mean or that the wise would reprove. Let none buy. Let one by something not wish harm to another. Even as a mother at the risk of her life watches over and protects her only child, so should one cherish all living things, suffusing love over the entire world, above, below, and all around without limit. So let one cultivate an infinite goodwill toward the whole world. Standing or walking, sitting or lying down, during all one's waking hours, let one practice the way with gratitude. Not holding to false views and doubt with insight. One who achieves the way will be free from the duality of birth and death. So let one cultivate an infinite goodwill toward the whole world. I had the opportunity at a meeting of teachers at Spirit Rock. Spirit Rock in Green Gulch organized a big Mahasangha meeting, and we had teachers from all of the various lineages of Buddhism who are active in this country today, which is kind of one of the wonderful things that's happening, you know. The Dharma is appearing in all its many guises, all the ways it's developed in different cultures all over the world. And what's happening in this country is that instead of there being sectarian groups competing with each other, we all seem to be working together with each other and appreciating each other. And these Mahasangha meetings are wonderful with teachers from all various lineages. And at this particular meeting, the first one, the Dalai Lama was there, and Mahagosananda was there. I don't know how many of you may have met Mahagosananda in your life, but he was a wonderful teacher. He was, I don't know if you know who he is, he was probably the senior member of the Cambodian Sangha when there was a great massacre of monks in Cambodia. He happened to be outside of the country at the time of the massacre. But when he came back, he led these marches all over Cambodia at the risk of his life. But he was having people chant the Metta Sutta and chant the verse from the Dhammapada. Hate is not overcome by hate. Only by love is hate overcome. This is the law eternal. So cultivating love is the only way we can eradicate hate in the world. We can't, aversion doesn't do it. We can't push it away. We have to, our work is loving the world. And as you know, in metta meditation, in meditation on loving kindness, we begin with those who are near and dear to us, but we continually expand and expand to include those that we're not so close to, maybe indifferent about, and continue expanding our metta practice until we can include wishing well-being and loving kindness for those who are very difficult for us to include. This is the work of loving the world. And this is also, in that very moment, cultivating gratitude and expressing gratitude to all those with whom we come in contact. We are here because we are supported by each other. This is this vast Indra's net in which I'm here because the plants are breathing out oxygen and breathing in my carbon dioxide. I'm here because the waters of the ocean evaporate and rain on us and provide moisture, which supports our life. I'm here because of untold causes and conditions for which I'm absolutely grateful because I like being here. But what I wanted to tell you about this Mahasangha meeting and Mahagosananda being there, at that time he was quite old and already suffering from quite a bit of senile dementia. There was generally someone assigned to accompany him so that he didn't wander off and get lost, because he's traveling around in a lot of places he's not familiar with, and he has short-term memory loss. But I wanted to go over and just express my gratitude to him and greet him. And as I was walking toward him, I felt viscerally, physically, these waves of loving kindness just emanating from him. And, you know, it reminded me of the Metta Sutta, suffusing love over the entire world, above, below, and all around, without limit. I mean, I felt it physically. It was just remarkable. that someone could cultivate loving kindness to such a degree that even as he was no longer actively directing his mind, it was just pouring out metta. You know, I want to be like that when I grow up. I remember I felt when I first met Suzuki Roshi, the first time he gave a talk, the first time I went to a talk of his, he said, "You're perfect just as you are. You know, you have everything you need." Well, he doesn't know me, I'm new here. You know. But he often spoke in that way. And it was his absolute conviction that each being is Buddha. Each one of us. Our fundamental nature is the nature of awakening. This is the teaching of the Buddha. It said, I wasn't there, so I don't know. It said that the Buddha said when he woke up, "Oh, I now see that all beings, without exception, have the wisdom and compassion of the awakened ones. But because of their delusions and self-clinging, they don't realize it." So can we recognize the wholeness and completeness of ourself and each being we meet? Can we see that each of us has the capacity to emanate loving kindness over the entire world, above, below, and all around, without limit? But we have to cultivate it. This is our work. Our work is loving the world. And we can do it. And what a great job to have. Each time we find ourselves losing our way and giving rise to aversion, you know, as soon as we notice, we can say, "That's going to take me to hell. I don't want to go there." We can do that. But we have to keep cultivating the capacity to catch it when aversion first arises and say, "That's going to make me miserable." Recognize it's up to me. Do I want to pick up that thought and build on it? Or do I want to relinquish it? We have more power over our mind than we imagine. But we need to be awake. Which is why we practice watching our mind and seeing how it works. And learning how to lead it down the paths we want it to go. And to avoid the danger spots. To recognize and avoid the danger spots. I want to leave a little time here for discussion if you have some question you want to raise. So perhaps I'll stop now. Okay.
Excuse me. Actually, our time is up. So for anyone who needs to leave at 10:45, okay, feel free to go ahead. And those of us who have a little more time to spend and ask questions, we should go ahead and do so. And if you would be good enough to wait for the microphone, that way people with hearing-assisted devices can hear you. Also, your question will come through on the web. Thank you.
I was listening very carefully to what you're saying about when these thoughts of suffering come up, you have to make a decision if you want to buy into those thoughts and head towards this hellish state, or relinquish them. And relinquishing thoughts has been an extremely difficult task for me. I was wondering if there's some insight you could provide on what's worked for you in terms of relinquishing thoughts that cause suffering.
Well, for me, as I say, the first important thing was to see that I was doing it. At that time, you know, I wasn't aware that, you know, it was sort of like, well, it's not my fault. I was sort of like, I was the victim, you know. I didn't mean to fall in love. It just happened to me. I didn't do it, you know. Well, on closer examination, there was something I was doing there. and I do find that bringing humor into it is very, very helpful for me. It's true that they can that some things can be very persistent. We are heavily conditioned, you know. But when we recognize a conditioning that is that leads to pain, that's the beginning. To recognize that thought, when I pick it up, and I hook it to the next and the next and the next, you know, when I get on that train of thought, it takes me to a miserable state of mind. That's the first thing that I have to do, is to see, oh, there's one that I don't want to feed. And we have to be pretty persistent about it. But once we are successful in one realm, and I have to say, this infatuation, which had been going on for some time and was mutual, the attraction was mutual. Within a few weeks of focusing on that, I want to drop it. You know, I want to drop that aspect of it that has entanglements in it. That person is still my close friend and my husband's close friend. You know. But the kind of sexual attraction that was happening there, it actually, I was able to dissipate it in a few weeks once I noticed that I was doing it, and it was a relief to the other person as well as to myself. We had two families. We didn't want to break up two families and go off in the sunset together. What do you think? But, as I say, seeing it, seeing that it's causing me misery and other people misery, and finding some humor. Like, for me at that time, that's where I don't want to get on that train that takes me to hell. You know, that was kind of a metaphor that helped me spot it quicker. But also humor works better for me than blame or criticism or shame or whatever other kinds of things I might use to stop it. Humor helps me. That's and really believing that I am the author of my thoughts, even though some may be kind of deeply ingrained because I've been going down that track so long, there's a real rut there that I tend to get into. But acknowledging that I am doing it. I'm not the sort of innocent victim of somebody else's nefarious scheme. This is my thought. And I have the capacity to say, I don't want to think like that today. no, thank you, not now. No, no, I'm sorry, no. You know, and just persistent, be persistent with it. Be persistent, but kind and gentle, not rough and nasty, but you don't want to do that, you know. Remember last time. That's really kind of the best insight I have from my own experience.
Thank you.
There's somebody back there.
You know, I did want to mention one other thing, and I'm too late for some of those who left at 10:45, but for the rest of us, to keep in mind that none of our teachers receives a salary, and that they all very much appreciate any dana that you give to them into the dana box next to the front door. Thanks.
Thank you. Hi. Right here.
Hi.
To want to cultivate loving kindness constantly, in all ways, in every way, is a great aspiration. And I mustn't allow myself to ignore when I also just, I notice aversion,
mm-hmm.
or I notice sexual thoughts, mm-hmm. whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say at work, aversion, and I don't want to go down that train to hell because I know that I will just spend the next half hour really hating and resenting that person instead of doing something constructive.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems like it's skillful to notice the aversion, to let it go gently, or try to let it go gently, and not insist that the metta arise when I want it to, but to allow it to rise when it will.
Mm-hmm. And I agree. I think that, but absolutely noticing aversion when it first arises and not feeding it is very important. Noticing all of the three, each of the three poisons, you know, aversion and grasping and clinging to a self. Or thinking that there's a self, some fixed entity of a self that they're to cling to. Yes, I agree that loving the world is you have to first start by not hating. That's the wrong direction. Let's take 180 here, you know. And I think that even when aversion arises, we can notice that that person is suffering too, you know, and see if we can find some compassion for the object of our aversion. There is something in us that is really compassionate. There is something in us that really wants to respond with compassion when we encounter suffering. And I have a friend whose mother recently died, and he's inherited some money, and this is someone who has never had any extra money, kind of. So he has been noticing people around him who are in deep distress, and it's been giving him such joy to be able to give them some money to help them out of their mess. I mean, it was really, I just happened to see, he came to see me recently, and you know, he's so delighted that he can actually help somebody who's in a big mess. And so I think this compassion is right close to the surface. All it needs is noticing someone suffering And often aversion arises in us because of meeting someone else's big aversive temperament, you know, and we respond with aversion. So when you can notice that person is suffering from their own problem with aversion, we don't have to meet it with aversion. We can meet it with compassion, recognizing it as suffering. I don't know if that's at all.
Yeah, it's about right effort.
And it is effort.
Yeah,
it is effort. When aversion arises in us, it has a lot of energy and momentum behind it. It's a very powerful emotion. And or it can be. And so it takes some real effort and energy to let it go. Or to find another way of looking at the situation that is not so negative. And that's what I mean by bringing compassion to mind. Is that person's deplorable conduct based on suffering? You know, maybe so. Yeah, there's somebody else.
Hi, my name is David. So far you've spoken of right effort mostly with regard to your effort with your own mind. Could you say a word about the cultural times of great pressure to participate in peace marches and town hall meetings and getting involved with things that are trying to set things right? My own experience is it starts with a good intention, but when I'm in it, I get very confused and I'm not very peaceful, very happy.
Right. This is actually what first caught my attention that actually led me to practice was I started practicing in 1969, so guess what was happening then, you know? I discovered, the words came out of my mouth about fighting, that I was fighting for peace. And I, oh, wait a minute. Isn't there something a little odd there? You know, where's the peace? You know, I was hating the guts of, well, I won't name names, but of the then, powers that be that were continuing this war in the most dreadful way and based on a falsehood to begin with. And similarly, a generation later. So even in that was what really got me to thinking about what am I doing? Is there a way in which I can actually make more peace around me than I'm doing now? Because I was very angry and so it's it's very hard for people who disagree with you to hear what you're saying if you're calling them an idiot, you know. You have to find a way of talking to, if you want to actually change somebody's mind, you have to talk to them in a way that respects them and tries to get them to see your point of view. But at that time, I was not able to do that. in that situation, I had a confrontation with a riot squad policeman. And it was a time when a moment when I was very, very concentrated. And we made eye contact. And I had a total overwhelming experience of identity with a riot squad policeman. And it blew my mind. You know, it was sort of like, how could a riot squad policeman and I be identical? As far as I was concerned, up until that moment, a riot squad policeman was sort of the epitome of not me. But the experience was so totally real that I could not argue with the fact that that happened. We were identical. There was some way in which that was totally true. And I started looking for who knew what that experience was. I had never heard the expression self and other and not two or anything about Indra's net or anything else. But the experience was totally real and incontrovertible, and I went looking for who could tell me what that experience was. And when I met Suzuki Roshi, I felt he knows what happened there. That's really how I came to practice then. I don't know if that's helpful. Well, thank you very, very much. It's been a wonderful pleasure to be here with you. May all beings wake up and enjoy being Buddha.